over to a particularly a tribe is that there is going to be a reluctance on the part of that group to convey. If you can convince them to, then they would have been taken over anyway. I'm thinking that there is, that one of the ways to protect from a takeover is to have a substantial minority or even a majority of stock, and then it's difficult to control. And that group inherently has a better ability to withstand a takeover. Now, let Monroe get in here.
I don't think I fully understand your example, so I can't answer it. And but let me make a couple of points. One of them is that, as we'll see in the AFN resolutions, there is some suggestion that there might be a limited opportunity to have flexibility for the purchase by corporations of individual stock prior to 1991. I think that there are possibly healthy things that could be done prior to 1991. I don't think it's possible that the Native community isn't generally prepared, it's building its own expertise and its own decision making, and I don't know whether it's at the point where it can say these are the things that could be done prior to 1991. But if it were, there could be such things. And one of them is the buyback provision. Just as an example, on the elders problem, one might determine that of all people, elders ought to be able to have some moderate cash in. If you thought anybody would, you might think elders might. You might not. You might not think that's true. You might think that, you may think as a safety valve that individuals who wish to sell a portion, 25% or 30% of the value of their stock ought to be able to do so either before 1991 or after. I mean, that the 1991 date is not an important date there. But it might help to resolve and relieve pressure on the 1991 question if there was a mild and modest door for some people to benefit to some extent. Now, I want to make it clear that, and this gets back to the what I was saying earlier, this doesn't mean that everybody ought to be able to sell, or that everybody ought to be able to sell 100% of the value of their stock, or that a Native corporation ought to be liable for an amount up to the amount that everybody wants to cash in for. You can divide it anyway. You could say that a corporation could set aside, could provide an amount up to X dollars, which is available at a certain price for people to buy in stock, and it would be by age or by percentage of stock or something like that. That is something that could be done, and it could be done prior to 1991, and it could be assistance in taking pressure off the restrictive element of the post-1991 planning. That is to say, if you have some small relief valve, it may be helpful in allowing better thinking about what should occur after 1991. On the question of elders or people willing their stock to Native corporations, if I were in that context, without knowing what's going to happen in the Native context,
it was to will them to the tribal government or some.
Oh, the tribal government.
That,
oh, okay.
That so, then accumulate me. Over time all the shares.
I see.
And the problems of takeovers would be avoided. That was okay. What I thought it was about.
Okay.
Sorry.
I don't have anything to say about that.
Yeah.
Now that I understand it, I don't have anything to say about it.
Monroe, the reason I brought it up is because you talked about the Getty Trust.
Right.
And that the advantages of the Getty Trust being a minority holder in a larger group and having control. My analogy is that a tribal group thus has certain values that it establishes, but it can work within a larger foreign group, but still maintain a semblance of control and also consolidate power that otherwise might just be dissipated by people just feeling helpless, and allowing individuals then to express what it is that they felt, and putting substance behind it.
Well, this goes to something that Elizabeth said earlier, and again, I think it's important to have someone with expertise on corporations. You could conceive of a situation in which the tribal government held the preferred stock in a corporation or the common stock, and somebody, and the current shareholders held the other, that in a way, and then the question would be, what are the rights of the preferred stockholders? And I think that one can build in certain protections or certain limitations on the actions of the corporation, either as a creditor or a preferred shareholder, that do constitute the kinds of controls that may be desirable. That one could do that and still maintain a market in common stock.
Well, I guess the reason I proposed mine is that I thought that you could have any variation of restrictions. My idea is that you would have people being able to participate within a state corporation as a tribal body as what, alongside others who chose not to do that and kept their stock holdings, and assuming that they could go ahead and sell, but the power of it is that you will at least find out before 1991 comes along where is the vote going to be, where is it going to be drawn, and if you do have a non-receptive Congress at that later date, then you at least have some inherent protections in LR, if hopefully, or not hopefully, one way or the other. I mean, you will know. I mean, you will not diminish the rights of the individuals because they'll still own their stock and they'll have whatever relative power that they have because of their individual holdings. But you won't diminish the interests of those people who have more of this group feeling simply because they aren't organized or haven't been able to find a way to organize or have a way to have the traditional landowner have an impact on the land management decisions of a state corporation. It's an idea that I don't know that may have been talked about. I wanted to find out. You know, my idea is that it's probably going to be more receptive in an area where the village corporation is viable anyway. It's not going to matter what the distribution is if it's not working, I suppose, or it may be.
I still don't understand.
Charlie Johnson.
I just want to ask a question, and it kind of was relating to what Tony was talking about and what you're talking about. Is it possible, under law of any kind, that, say, the dissenters were issued a convertible stock at some point, that in a kind of reverse fashion, you know, you can it could be convertible into debt. Like, for example, now you can go out and buy say corporate bonds that are convertible to stock. Is it possible to structure it in a way for those dissenters that get some kind of a preferred bond that they can transfer to their stock into? I don't know the answer. I'm just wondering that.
I don't think anyone's prepared to answer that, Charlie. Glenn Fredericks?
The only other comment I would have is, doesn't the Act itself, Bart, said that we could divide the land and give it to the shareholders equally? And there's a provision in the Act that we could divide if the desire of the people, the shareholders. I was thinking about what you said. Then they could turn around once you issued a deed to them, say my area is 10,000 acres apiece, why can't I get that document and then revert it back to an IRA or a different entity? I think there's a provision in the Act itself already.
And as the Act was finally passed, Glenn, I'm not aware of any specific authorization for liquidation. There's always a possibility of a liquidation under state law.
We could. Isn't there, Elizabeth? There's.
It's not ringing the bell with me, Glenn.
No, I don't recall.
I thought there was a place there that said, Charlie, that we could, if we had 1,000,000 acres, we could divide it up if that's the desire of the people to liquidate the land. We can liquidate the asset very quickly. I mean, we know what it is, cash assets. And
I'm not aware of anything like that.
I'm not only not aware of it in ANCSCA, but again, if you did it under state law, you'd want a vote of the shareholders, and you'd want, of all the times, you'd want to disclose to the shareholders the consequences of what they were doing and the meaning of what they were doing. It would be in that. You'd never want to just do it. okay, and it would be under state law.
If you're in my position, you wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't want to do it because I wouldn't last that long, you know. My theory is that the shareholders have to make those decisions, not the board of directors. There's no way in hell that board can make those decisions, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the people out there has to make the decision. In the concept of this, putting the land aside, too, the shareholders have to make that decision. Only thing the board of directors, as I see it, will have to do is go to the members and say, these are your options, you know. Either sell out or do something. These are the options. You make the choice. You know?
Bart Garber?
I don't have all that much faith, actually, in the idea I've proposed. It more to me expresses one theoretical middle ground where you are appeasing different interests, where you don't deny someone dissenters' rights if you do it, but you're allowing people to go ahead and make an individual decision, but make an individual decision to opt for a communal holding if that's what they want. It's a little bit repugnant to me, even just in some of these votes where you're denying dissenters' rights. In one village, it's going to be you're going to be denying. Well, actually, it doesn't make much sense when you have the dissenters are tribal people, because I don't know what the vote would be that would come about. But you're always going to have an out group when you have a simple majority or even a supermajority, when you may have a significant minority of upwards of 25% of the people not wanting to go along with something that the corporation has. Now, I know that that's always going to exist, but particularly in situations if you've got dissenters who prefer an individual kind of property right but wanted to continue with the management of the corporation, and you deny them dissenters' rights, there's a clear, you know, they're not going to be able to pull their assets out. What troubles me is that the future of management of that corporation, where you've created a minority there who is really not very happy about what's happening, and yet they are still there. This kind of addresses a little bit. I can't remember if it was you, Roland, who talked about it, that these are lots of people that corporations usually come together because people have these common interests, and that they run fairly well because they usually have common goals and they go in one direction. The problem is when you eliminate dissenters' rights is you make the management of that entity afterwards very difficult. You just constantly ruffle feathers, and it will be difficult to continue. So if you can find some way, I don't know about the substance of what you do, but some way that somehow appeases two sides and they can still find a way to continue, but at least be able to express their feelings rather than just being chopped off. That's one of my concerns.
Gary Enders and John Taylor.
My question, as an economist, really deals with the marketplace for native stock. It's not clear to me exactly how the fair market price would be determined because of certain provisions within the Act, including 7I. Given that as I understand it now, the time frame expires and stock can be sold, I would like to know what kinds of provisions can be built into the legislation to allow more time for deliberation. Bart, earlier you mentioned analogy with limited entry permits. I think that's a good example of mechanisms that allow for non-impulse sales of a valuable asset, and I'd like to know if you've done some thinking with regard to the structure of the transfer process. In other words, how, if in fact these shares of stock are going to be sold in the marketplace, what kinds of provisions can be built in to give people more time to evaluate the range of choices that are open to them, including putting them in a separate tribal entity.
Elizabeth?
The only one I'm aware of initially was what was put into ANILCA, where there was the right of first refusal concept. It was my understanding of that concept was that it was not put in there because the people who put it in felt that the corporations maybe realistically could meet the fair market value that was being offered outside, but rather that it was put in as precisely a mechanism to deal with the impulse sale and also to deal with perhaps the question of conflicting values, and put in also to deal with perhaps educating somebody about what the value is. After all, there are two parades of horribles that can happen here. The first one is that the natives will lose control of the land. But the second parade of horribles is that if they lose control of the land, in addition, they will not even be paid for it. Neither one of those is a particularly appealing prospect. And so I think the right of first refusal was put in as a mechanism to begin to deal with it's the only mechanism I know of so far that's been discussed. And again, others can correct me on this, but it's the only one I'm aware of that's been discussed to try to deal with the impulse sale, to try to deal with education of value. If somebody's been offered $3 a share and you know perfectly well that in this corporation it's worth $50 a share, and the person who's been offered it just doesn't happen to know that, you can educate him on that. And also, of course, there would be the discussions in the back room about perhaps you don't want to sell your shares because what it will, the total impact it would have on native control.
Has any corporation adopted the ANILCA amendments? Have they passed resolutions binding on their shareholders that require them to give first right of refusal to the family or the corporation and so forth?
We have.
I see.
In the annual shareholders meeting about 2 years ago, we put that provision in. We also have a provision in our bylaws that if there's a corporation by our area out there that is ready to defunct and about to lose their land, the board was given authorization from the shareholders to negotiate for that land. Now it's up to the board then to go to this village corporation and make a deal with them, and my idea there was to give them non-voting rights. Why should I give them voting rights if they used up all their assets? Only thing what we were trying to do was to protect their land, and they would only have vote on that, on their land, if we were to do something on it. We have that already in our bylaws. So anybody that's going under, tell me. We can make a quick deal.
John Taylor and then Charlie.
Yes, Bart, you sparked an idea, and I wish Dan Fessler was here so I could get some feedback on it. But as you were talking, it sounded to me initially as if you were talking about a modified voting trust of some kind. And maybe that's an idea that we ought to explore more, because I know in Dan's recommendations for the new corporate statutes, he addresses that again. But maybe there's more to be looked into that particular area in state corporate law to sort of get at the direction you were going to.
I'll
pass. I got some more interesting one than I was going to ask anyway.
Elizabeth?
The only concern, as we thought it through on voting trusts, was the concern that somehow, on one hand, it might do what Bart is talking about, which is to be able to make a group that would be strong enough to see if somebody offered to buy their shares, they would see the consequences of selling. One of the problems when individuals own the shares is it's sort of an incremental thing. You know, it doesn't matter if I sell my shares, surely native control will be not lost if I sell my shares. If you have it grouped, it's easier to see the real impact if the shares go. But one of the concerns we had at Bristol Bay about the voting trust or similar ideas was that it might harden factions. In the 8 years I've been at Bristol Bay, factions have shifted and changed, and I tended to think that was good. And the voting trust situation often doesn't allow that to happen, and that was in an institutional sense, in terms of trying to build a strong institution that could survive that, I think that was our concern.
But that's also one of the strengths that, you know, the counter strengths on the backside is if you do have a lot of running around between a minority dissident group or something, and as Bart was trying to point out, then with a voting trust, you really lock that up very quickly.
Those who sign up as dissidents in a trust initially, okay, I mean, because obviously if you cannot honorably, I think, go to Congress and say, we're only allowing some people to go over in this group, and those are the guys on this good side. If you're going to open this up, you're going to open it up to all sorts of factions. Okay, you set your factions, and once your factions are set, once they sign up, they're locked in. And if 3 years later, suddenly management looks good to them, even if I'm part of that management, it still looks good to them, I'd love to see them be able to slip back, and they can't.
Okay, well, it's, yeah, Charlie.
Let me ask one other question that has come up. It seems that one of the real concerns, and we addressed this earlier, was not only control but ownership of land. And maybe, Liz, you can answer this as well as anybody. In the Seven Eye Agreement, is there any protection for anybody where transfers of land might take place, irregardless of who the stockholders are of any corporation? Since between regions, there is some provisions for scrutinizing any transfers of land or asset or resources.
Charlie, I can't answer that, but if you wanted, I could get you an answer before, you know, two more days passed. I'm sorry I'm not on top of the 7i agreement, and there are a few other people in this room who might be on top of it more than I am. But I could find you an answer, but I sure don't have it right now.
I would also require at least till tomorrow morning, but to get a totally accurate answer. I think one question is whether certainly 7i persists after 1991, and that's a major question, and the 7i agreement recognizes that. Secondly, the sale of any asset that's subject to 7i would trigger a distribution under 7i, and one element of the agreement was how to determine whether or not there was a fair market transaction involving that. And the precise aspect of that is what we'd have to check. One other thing, though, that's relevant that came up, I think, obliquely in the 7i context is whether decisions by a particular native corporation to restrict the value of assets subject to 7i also raise questions with respect to other native corporations. That wasn't treated under the 7i agreement. I say, let's say there's a valuable asset in Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Rather than sell it for below market value, they just basically restrict it in a way that means that it doesn't produce value. That has effects on other native corporations. But that, I think, is within the province of the corporation. That isn't affected by the 7i agreement.
Well, I think that, yes, sir,
I wanted to ask a question that's been occurring to me, and again, maybe no one here can answer it, but this whole impact of 7i, you know, when people come and they want to buy stock and take over assets, the mythical and hypothetical village corporation that Roland mentioned is not burdened by 7i. It may be benefited by 7j, but it's not burdened by 7i. But the regional corporations' land holdings are burdened by 7i. And what I was wondering was, if I were sitting here and a shrewd takeover of assets, on one hand, to take over the regional corporation stock might seem to me to be shrewd because I could acquire it in increments and nobody, you know, would really truly realize totally what I was doing until it was too late. But on the other hand, would I really want to buy the corporation stock, whereby that's how I got the corporation assets and might have the burden then of 7i, as opposed to in the village situation that that just isn't operative and you would follow your strategies of trying to take over assets or take over stock and thereby assets any way you wanted. And I didn't know Monroe or Tony or anyone else, Bart, who might have a response.
Price, I would think.
It would be a question of price, and I think that if you found that there were a number of takeovers of regional corporations, you would strengthen the argument for going to Congress and saying, look, the original reason for 7i was to share the wealth among native people. Now they're out of it, so let's go back to free enterprise as we really know it. On the other hand, some of them might regard 7i as an attractive feature.
Well, I think some people would be buying corporations for the rights to receive benefits from other native corporations. And one of the for some native corporations, one of their most valuable assets is revenues from other native corporations.
Buy a native corporation,
it's true.
Divest yourself of all the assets, and just sit there and wait for 7i revenue.
Well, yeah.
I think this has a tendency to go round and round a bit, and we usually stop at about 4:15 or 4:30. So perhaps you'd just allow me to say a few words before we adjourn. And Chris McNeil, I understand you won't be able to come back tomorrow. I want to thank you for coming today and participating. Some of those who were not able to be here today will, I understand, be joining us tomorrow. The idea tomorrow is to look at the AFN resolutions and talk about them and see if we learn something from them and if the AFN might learn something from our discussion on today's showing. Who can be sure? But would just ask you, though, to bear a number of things in mind that seem to me to be vital. And I mentioned this at the beginning, but it seems to me that the bedrock of what's going on here is the desire of people in the bush who regard their land as their people's land to be passed on from one generation to the next, to be available for subsistence. That's the bedrock. If those people weren't out there talking that way, we might not have very much to talk about, and I think we should bear that in mind. And how can you protect that land against three things, it seems to me? One is corporate failure by reason of activities that the corporation may be carrying on having nothing to do with the land. Glenn Frederick's corporation might have a big series of bad investments in Anchorage that threaten the land out in the bush that his 1,200 shareholders are using. Now that, it seems to me, is something to be considered. Second thing is corporate takeovers. Well, we spent a lot of time on that. How do you protect against corporate takeovers? And the third, what do you do with the land to protect it against corporate takeovers? Or what do you do with the corporation to protect the land that the corporation holds? And the third thing, and I brought this up earlier, but I intend to bring it up again, is taxation. Elizabeth pointed out that there may be a growing mood in the state to tax rural land, and if so, what about subsistence land? It doesn't generate revenue. It is not able to support taxation. If the corporation that holds the land is unable to pay taxes, where are you then? I think that in the course of our discussion, we might bear in mind Tony Strong's proposals. Two of them, it seems he said, what about holding the shares in a life estate? That didn't seem to fly, mainly because none of us know that much about it, I gather. The second one, the land should be held by native governments with an exclusive right of development to the native corporations. That may be reflected in some of the AFN resolutions, I don't know. And the sale back to the corporations, as I told you this morning, I think you have to think pretty hard about the sale of shares back to the corporations, because you inevitably will create two classes of shareholders, two classes of native people, those with shares and those without shares, but this time not an arbitrary judgment of Congress based on the age or the particular date, but on the choice that people make and that they may soon regret. The only other thing I want to mention is that we are having a roundtable in December. We devoted this one, or we're devoting this one, to 1991 and all that that entails. In December, we're having a roundtable to look at alternate approaches to native land and government, and Ralph Johnson, who's here with us, is preparing a paper to open the discussion on that, and we have some people from the Lower 48 and other countries to come to talk about how they're approaching these issues. But we thought it was worthwhile looking at 1991 by itself because, as I said earlier, and no one's argued, been prepared to argue with me about it, this is a unique setup in Alaska, and getting all these other people from other countries in here and confusing them might not be helpful. So if it's okay with you, let's start again at 9 in the morning, and we'll look at the AFN resolutions. Well, I was going, can you get us copies of the very latest version, Charlie?
Got copies? Oh, that'd be great if you could do that.
Would you do that?
Sure. Terrific. I have all of that. Yeah, I thought I had copies. Sure. That got time.
I'll be around for I'm just warning.